I'm Kathy Miller, Professor of Medicine at the Indiana University School of Medicine in Indianapolis. Welcome to this edition of Medscape Oncology Insights, coming to you from the 2014 San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. The neoadjuvant setting increasingly has become a testing ground for novel therapies in the hopes that this will allow us to show efficacy and avoid a much larger, lengthy process of testing in the adjuvant setting. But is this really a viable strategy? Can or should those neoadjuvant trials serve as a route to accelerated registration? Well, to discuss that provocative issue, I've invited two leaders in breast cancer research to join me, Dr. Clifford Huddis, Chief of Breast Cancer Medicine Service at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, and Dr. George Sledge, Professor of Medicine and Chief of the Division of Oncology at the Stanford University, and Professor of Medicine and Chief of the Division of Oncology at the Stanford Women's Cancer Center in Stanford. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Now, I know you are both not short of opinions on this subject. So, Cliff, what do we learn in the neoadjuvant setting?
Well, first of all, I think that we may be asking a lot out of a relatively small set of data, but I think we do learn a good bit in the neoadjuvant setting, just maybe not everything. So I think the neoadjuvant setting is a really efficient way to potentially screen drugs for activity. I think it's a really important and efficient way to do early translational and correlative science experiments, translational science and correlative science, so that we can understand what works, why it works, why it doesn't work, and so forth. But in your introduction, you alluded to the possibility of also learning from that setting what works long-term for disease control leading to improved survival. And I think there the jury is more out than in on whether that's an effective strategy.
Well, the FDA jury is in, at least with their draft guidance, and they have now given accelerated approval to at least one agent based on neoadjuvant testing. George, are you comfortable with that as a strategy to accelerated approval?
Well, I'm comfortable with it as a hypothesis from a scientific standpoint. First, we know that if a patient has a pathologic complete response, we know that that person as an individual has very good prognosis. PCR is associated with a very good rate of long-term survival. And I think that is consistent across every study that we've ever done. But the real question is if we're looking at arm A versus arm B in a neoadjuvant trial, and we see a delta between arm A and arm B, does that correlate with improved disease-free survival in an adjuvant trial? Does it correlate with improved overall survival in an adjuvant trial? And there I would say the data is conflicting at best, but in general actually probably negative. Pat Cortazar of the Food and Drug Administration and an international group of investigators brought together all of these neoadjuvant trials where arm A had been compared to arm B. And in general, when one does a statistical analysis of these trials, it's very, very difficult to come up with a delta between two trials that correlates with a delta in disease-free survival. And from a practical matter, as clinical scientists, that's actually what we need. We would love to have some formula that would say that this, in fact, is what happens. This improvement in PCR rate is associated with this improvement in disease-free survival rate. We can't do that.
So in the absence of that, though, we still have this draft guidance in effect. We have a drug, pertuzumab, currently approved for the neoadjuvant setting, not approved for the adjuvant setting. And for our listeners, in practice, that I think puts them in a difficult position when they're looking at a patient who comes to see them. So some specific difficulties that we've heard that I would love to hear how you two handle.
Yeah. Well,
so Cliff, one of them, yeah. a young to mid-age woman, exceedingly healthy, who had a 5-centimeter tumor with an obvious palpable node, but who told her surgeon, "This is making me crazy. I want mastectomy, and I want it now." And the surgeon honors her wishes and takes her directly to the operating room. She's now seeing you, probably someone who, had you seen her in the neoadjuvant setting, neoadjuvant therapy would have been quite reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do now?
Well, so I've spent a lot of time on this, and I will say out loud, I actually spoke at length to many of the good people at the FDA in preparation for the labeling of pertuzumab, because I had real concerns, which I've expressed very plainly on this, and this case highlights it. So let me expand on it for a minute. Ms. Smith walks down 2nd Avenue in New York City. She has a 3-centimeter cancer, HER2 positive. She makes a right-hand turn into Facility A, has a mastectomy, and is a candidate for conventional trastuzumab-based adjuvant therapy. She makes a left turn into Institution B, and they refer her for neoadjuvant therapy. In that second case, per the label, she gets pertuzumab along with her therapy. Now, the public health reason for accelerated approval, it seems to me, is to make a difference in people's lives. The label given to the drug was for 4 to 6 cycles of therapy.
Because it was a neoadjuvant trial.
And
trial
that's the data,
stopped at surgery.
Right, and that's the data they got, and I understand that completely. However, back to George's point, the guidance document and, indeed, the actions of the FDA call for confirmatory data from the adjuvant setting. And the thing about the pertuzumab label is everybody knew there was a survival advantage in metastatic disease, which I don't think it's a stretch to call unprecedented. It's one of the biggest survival deltas we've seen. That's supporting. And the AFFINITY trial was finished. So that data will come in. So you get accelerated approval. Here's the problem. Everybody who gives 4 to 6 months or cycles of pertuzumab for the next 2 years waiting for AFFINITY will wake up in a couple of years and let's just say AFFINITY is positive. The query is, did they save a single life? The answer is, can't be known because the AFFINITY data will be for a year of therapy. So I've given you a long walk in terms of the answer. What we do, and I feel strongly and passionately about this, is that I give a year of pertuzumab to anybody who would have qualified for pertuzumab one way or the other. I don't care if it's pre-op or post-op. And we actually pushed a little bit so that the NCCN guideline was just a little vague on this issue for that reason. I actually have a truly moral objection to the notion of 4 or 6 months of the drug when you believe it's life-saving, since that may not be.
Well, at this point, we don't know if it's life-saving at all.
Right.
Though I think the data in the metastatic setting would have, I'm going to take the liberty of saying the three of us all surprised if the AFFINITY trial is
not a
positive trial. But it does put our practitioners in that quandary. It has the potential to put patients at financial risk for different coverage. So Cliff is going to give that woman who had her surgery first a year of pertuzumab. If she takes a bigger left-hand turn all the way across the country to your office in Stanford, what are you going to do with her?
I'm going to do what her insurance company allows me to do, because these are very expensive drugs. But Cliff brings up a really important point, which is one of the issues with neoadjuvant therapy is because it's neoadjuvant, it doesn't teach us very much about duration. Now, if we look at trastuzumab, for instance, we know, or at least we think we know, that 6 months of trastuzumab in the adjuvant setting is not as good as a year of trastuzumab in the adjuvant setting. As new drugs and new biologics come along for treatment of breast cancer and use in the neoadjuvant setting, the neoadjuvant setting is probably not going to be the best place to tell us, answer questions about duration. And in fact, we may lose in the long run if we choose duration wrong.
You know, you bring up a point, and I feel a certain tension about it. The problem is, I may be making a mistake. We all may be making a mistake, but we have to go to a clinic like people watching this and make a real decision for a real patient. So I would rather make the mistake for 2 years of a little bit of overtreatment, and it's expensive, than make the mistake of the undertreatment if it turns out to be positive. That's just a value judgment.
But the undertreatment also, because we have no way of knowing if the undertreatment, it helped her a little bit in terms of her overall survival, but maybe not as much as a full year of duration. That would certainly be what we saw with the shorter duration trastuzumab studies.
Right.
Those patients didn't get no benefit. It just wasn't quite as much. But we won't know. Did she get no benefit at all? Did she get kind of partial benefit? Did she get the full benefit? And if the reason to treat people in the neoadjuvant setting is the same as the reason to treat them in the adjuvant setting, this dichotomy creates a tension.
Well, I want to add to it. If adding to all of that, which is true, if the reason for accelerated approval when the data is evolving is to make a public health impact, the public health impact is not the PCR. The rate of breast conservation is really no different on the two arms of those trials. These are not patients, by and large, with inoperable disease being salvaged or saved from mastectomy. the practical impact of the PCR on those patients is actually not really detectable except for good news. And the long-term implications of that good news are exactly what George described before. So my issue is in a way, more nuanced. I'm not sure it makes any difference just to happen to get a bump in the PCR rate. Now, I want to be very clear about this. My prediction, and it's just a bet, but I don't have any data, is that because of what we know, pertuzumab will be effective as adjuvant therapy. But we could consider in the same discussion lapatinib. And if you're careful about it, you can find a delta in PCR for lapatinib pretty much like pertuzumab. And as we know from last year at ASCO, that doesn't necessarily translate into an impact on long-term outcomes. So the principle isn't there for me, which brings me back to why do it. Do it to save lives. If you're going to do it to save lives, I think you have to take a gamble and gamble on what's being tested to save lives.
So, George, we have surgeons who tune in as well. If Cliff Smith turns right into that facility and has her immediate surgery, has the surgeon done something wrong?
No. I mean, the surgeon has done what the surgeon thinks is appropriate. In general, wherever we've tested it, neoadjuvant therapy and adjuvant therapy give you identical survival outcomes. So having the surgery...
If the therapy is the same.
If the therapy
is
the same.
Which is our problem here.
And that is the question. Is the therapy going to be the same? And at least in the short run, the therapy won't be the same. It's not that the surgeon's done something wrong. It's perhaps the system has done something wrong.
The other area where there's been enthusiasm for PCR as a surrogate is in the triple negative setting. At this point, no drugs approved in that setting based on PCR, though an ongoing phase 3 trial with that as the hope, looking at a PARP inhibitor in triple negative patients. Do we have any greater sense of that correlation between PCR and long-term outcome in the triple negative versus the HER2?
Well, if we look at the Cortisar analysis, the answer is no. In the Cortisar analysis, it didn't matter which subtype you had. You were unable to show that delta PCR equals delta DFS for any of the particular subtypes. So currently, we'd have to say the answer to that is no. Now, let me say something in fairness to the FDA, because the FDA is in their draft guidance was quite frank about saying that they went in approving something based upon neoadjuvant therapy. They were approving it based on the totality of the data. Mm-hmm. Now, the totality of the data for pertuzumab, for instance, includes a metastatic overall survival advantage. It includes a large amount of safety data. It includes the fact that as Cliff mentioned, that a phase 3 adjuvant trial is already in the bank and waiting to be evaluated. But we're not going to get that every single time. We were lucky to get that with pertuzumab, but we're certainly not going to get that with every drug that comes along. And I think that's a big question.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, the other point, of course, is the subtypes do matter, which is indirectly what you're asking about. And one has to also be aware of the fact that some of the most important drugs from a public health point of view really don't give us PCRs ever in the ER-positive setting. And in the draft guidance, they steer you away as an investigator or a company from thinking about ER-positives for this approach.
So the other thing that this means we will have to consider as a community is the very real possibility, perhaps not with pertuzumab, but with some agent at some future time, accelerated approval based on improvement in PCR, that a subsequent study, appropriately powered and followed for long-term outcome, doesn't pan out.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens at that point?
I think it's an interesting question, because in the case of pertuzumab, it's perhaps less damaging than it would seem at first. The drug is approved. It has its other indications. And so if one were to withdraw the label for that indication, you know, no harm is done.
No change
actually
to people in the metastatic
right
setting.
Right.
But for some drugs, this could be their first
sure
route, and that could remove an agent entirely.
It could, although I think George's point is really a subtle but important one, which is the totality of the data. It'd be surprising to me right now that a drug would garner only an approval in the neoadjuvant setting because the totality of the data at the moment would therefore, by definition, be limited to just PCR, which would seem to me to make it unlikely to happen. Maybe one could imagine that happening, but I don't see it so easily.
So, Josh, I'm also thinking about the harm that we've done in that time.
Mm.
Because in however long a time it is between accelerated approval, an ultimate study, and withdrawal of that approval, regardless of whether it's just a change in indication or a complete removal from the market, there will be many, likely thousands, of women who have been treated, some of whom individually may have benefited that we won't be able to identify, but some who will have clearly been harmed with toxicities. No matter how well-tolerated drugs are, they all have some toxicity that in some patients is particularly severe. What do we as a community say to those women when they come back and ask us?
Well, we've been there before. I mean, obviously we were there before in the 90s with high-dose chemotherapy and stem cell transplantation, where the popularity contest at the moment condemned thousands of women to therapy that did not benefit them and arguably harmed them. You know, the nature of clinical research, I always remember Ben Bradley's discussion of newspapers. He said that they were the first rough draft of history. Our clinical trials are probably the same thing. They're the first rough draft, and sometimes very rough, of medical history. We learn as we go along. Hopefully, we learn carefully. Hopefully, we don't harm our patients. Hopefully, we don't overexpose them to therapies that will harm them.
You know, you've captured, I think, actually the real tension that the regulators have to confront and manage. And no matter what it might sound like, I'm saying this is the reason I have tremendous respect for them. This is a very delicate balancing act between the pressure to do more, better, faster than we have before and the inevitable backlash against the occasional unfortunate harm. And getting it right is probably not possible. It's a never-ending game of lefts and rights and adjustments. And we are all in this together.
And PCR, I think you actually just gave a great analogy. PCR is our first draft of efficacy in an early stage setting. First drafts are sometimes good drafts. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're substantially rewritten before they come to their final version.
Right. I think that's true. Look, I actually think that it will turn out that getting pertuzumab labeled in the neoadjuvant setting was a good thing, although I would have preferred a more ambitious or aggressive stance, as you heard. But I do think that doesn't mean it's a principle that's established. It may not be a principle. It may just be, in this circumstance, you know, all the forces were aligned.
So, George, do you think it's a good thing?
I think it is for pertuzumab. And again, I go back to that phrase, the totality of the data. Certainly in the metastatic setting, we have never before seen a drug that improves something by as much in terms of overall survival as pertuzumab has. One has to think that that's going to translate in the adjuvant setting. Perhaps we'll be wrong, but I doubt it. This is an exceptional difference. If it were a 2 or 3 month difference, one would worry.
Well, on that, I will thank you both for joining us for this really important and thought-provoking discussion. And to you, our audience, thank you for joining us in this edition of Medscape Oncology Insights. This is Kathy Miller reporting from San Antonio.